Hey, I'm Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore here in Scottsdale, Arizona, and good evening. And thanks for attending another of our virtual events. And tonight we have L. Allison Heller. She's going to be talking about her book, The Neighbor's Secret. And she has agreed to send us some signed book plates. So if you order a copy, we'll hang on to it until we get those. Shouldn't be too long. And I will go ahead and put a link in the comments field should you want to order one. And if you have any questions for Allison or Barbara, just go ahead and put them in the comments field and I'll be monitoring that through the hour. And don't be shy. And I'll turn it over to you, Barbara.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Well, a salute to you, Allison. I forgot to tell you, all our events are BYOB.
Oh, well.
Got one too? Oh, well, we all have different ones.
It's less exciting, but volume makes up for content.
Well, in Colorado, it's a little bit later than where we are here. So I'm sure I was telling Allison, the whole supply system is so screwy at the moment that sometimes we go into these and we don't really know what we have to offer or, in fact, when it will show up. But good news is that Allison's book's actually here as compared to many of the events we are doing, which are turning into pre-events. And she has kindly agreed to sign book plates for us. So, yay. Allison, this is your third book.
This is my third book.
Okay.
But and my first defense.
I was just going to say, your first two books, I looked and your publisher and so forth classifies them. I hate all this labeling stuff, but that's the way it goes. We don't do that at the Poison Pen. We have one shell. I mean, one huge file is called fiction, you know. But anyway, women's fiction is, what do you understand women's fiction to be? Let me ask you that. That's a good question.
Oh, that is such a good question, Barbara. I mean, I have always quibbled with the name women's fiction because to me, it's just fiction. And I think when they were categorized, my publisher was thinking, or, you know, the category was stories about women dealing with issues of women. But I kind of in my head just think of them as contemporary fiction now.
I agree with you. And I think it's really sort of sexist to say, you know, that only women are dealing with this. Now there's right. a number of the British are really into motherhood in a more deep diving way, at least in fiction. I don't know if they actually do this in real life, but I mean, it becomes a whole life. And there are all kinds of code words and conventions and so forth that you have to, you know, to follow or be a pariah in your neighborhood or something. Now those I do think of as women's fiction because I don't see men doing that kind of stuff. But many of the books that I see here called women's fiction that's too narrow. A label, you know, a lot of that just comes from algorithms and it comes from the, I'm trying to remember what they call them, but they're tags that are put onto books so that they sell on many online retailer sites. Now, the good news about the Poison Pen, we're an online retailer. We're actually quite a serious online retailer, but we decide what we want to say about the books. And so we don't care if they have these kinds of tags. And I asked you that question because leading into A Neighbor's Secret, did it start out for you without the suspense element? And did the suspense element come in, or did you intend it from the very beginning to be what we could call a modern suspense novel?
Very beginning, a suspense novel. And I think it's a different kind of suspense novel. My publicist called it a neighborhood thriller, which I thought was great. Because it really, the characters, I'm very concerned with their interior life. And the tension, what I wanted the tension to come from, what I was trying to do was the tension of parenting and the stress of parenting and also of maintaining this perfect facade in life. And that is where the tension comes from, you know, so it's not necessarily from someone around the corner holding a knife, but it's the worry and the anxieties.
So you really had to create something like the Cottonwood Estates, which is a enclosed community. I mean, it's actually an expansion of the whole Agatha Christie, you know, country house murder thing, and that you have a geographic and really emotional boundary around a community. So when things are happening, really only those people that live in it are involved. You're not expecting a serial rapist from, you know, the city 2 miles away or something.
Exactly. To come in,
into your estate. So the people who live there are the people that you're focused on.
Exactly. And in fact, I think there are only two scenes, I think, that take place outside of the neighborhood. And there's only one, not a main character, but an important character who lives outside the neighborhood. And even she has a connection to the neighborhood. So it's very bubbled.
It is. Well, I mean, here in the West, because I'll take Scottsdale, for example. Scottsdale has been developed piecemeal. And basically what's happened is that a developer will buy a ranch because initially, you know, this was just ranch country. Mm-hmm. So the developer buys like, you know, the AKA Thoroughbred Arabian Horse Ranch or something. And then basically what they have to do is build a wall around it. And then they, you know, they divide it up into lots. And that becomes a neighborhood. And then within that, if you have a swimming pool, you know, legal training kicks in. In order to avoid liability, you have to have walls around your house or at least around your pool. Oh. So what we wind up with is we have a series of basically gated communities. And then within the community, the houses are almost all enclosed by walls. And many of them are ruled by HOAs, homeowner associations. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, they can be fiefdoms like you could hardly imagine. And if you get the wrong person running your HOA, you could be just miserable.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have one, let's say, for example, if you didn't have one controlling rules like short-term rentals, you could find that in your relatively enclosed neighborhood, you could wind up with an Airbnb house, a short-term rental house, if the HOA rules didn't preclude that. And that can lead to all kinds of disasters. And in fact, that goes on in Scottsdale and Phoenix all the time. And in other Western communities, because most developed that way. I mean, Las Vegas, you know, whatever. It's much more of a Western thing than it is an Eastern thing, where I grew up in a suburb north of Chicago, for example. Mm-hmm. And Wenatchee was a relatively enclosed community, but there weren't any actual walls. You know, but right. it was still a very right. big community from, let's say, Highland Park or Kenilworth or,
right.
or Evanston or something. It had its right. own boundaries, even if they weren't so specific. So what's the Cottonwood Estates? What model is it?
Well, like you, I'm in the West. I'm outside of Denver.
Right.
And so there are a lot of neighborhoods that are very similar to what you describe, a ranch divided up. We don't have the walls or the pool thing as much. There are a lot of community pools. Right. And there are definitely HOAs. And I remember when we were looking at houses, some of them had very, as you said, you know, they sort of are their own cultures. And that was absolutely 100% what I had in mind, you know, is kind of creating this bubble where people who really care about the culture they're creating and specifically how they're raising their kids can mandate and try and ensure and enforce that life goes a certain way. With strict rules and everyone looking out for each other. And so I very much wanted a place that had a warm community feel, but also a community feel that could get a little oppressive.
So that can put a lot of pressure, particularly on the women. I mean, mm-hmm. the men in general go off somewhere, although certainly not during COVID, everybody's been home. So God only knows how that that whole dynamic has
right,
changed. But
let's
say, for argument's sake,
right.
Cottonwood Estate is a place where the men tend to go out to work, or the wives go out to work for that matter. But there are people home-minding children, home-minding pets. My husband and I, in a moment of madness in August, at our age, have adopted, we're new parents. We have two puppies. They came to us at 3 months old. They weigh 4 pounds each. Now they're 4 months old and they've made it up to 7. And Allison, I've been a mother for, you know, I mean, I'm 80 years old and I can barely remember what it was like, you know, to be doing potty training and, you know, chasing after kids and all. And I thought, in these communities in your neighborhood, you know, if they're babies and all, somebody, whether maybe you have a nanny, doesn't really, somebody is home.
I've forgotten
how absolutely unrelenting the time involved in raising a child or a dog.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's
nonstop. Yeah, it's nonstop. Are you sleeping? Are you?
We sort of take it in turns. Yes. My husband is better at getting up at night, and then he likes to go out more in the daytime because I work at home, you know, virtually all the time now. So, and it's a nice break in a way, you know, how you're supposed to get up from your computer or, you know, suffer dire physical breakdown.
That's right.
So, you know, it's not a problem now. I don't get to sit for, you know, 3 or 4 hours. I hear the yip, you know, and it's like, mom, it's time to potty. You know. and puppy Pilates is really great because if you're constantly picking up, you know, these little things. So
that's kind of Pilates.
Yeah, I love puppy Pilates, but it's very helpful. Nonetheless, I had completely forgotten how it closes your life in your home. Mm-hmm. And it focuses you on what's going mm-hmm. on in your home with whatever human or animal or both that you are in charge of.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what's going on in the lives of some of the women that you are writing about.
Yes.
Or has gone on in
yes.
their lives. Yes. You know, maybe their kids are grown.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So I read your book at just the right time.
Exactly.
I tripped back into the past. Yeah, the thing that's really fun about the Cottonwood Estates and about Allison's creation here, because it's basically world building, and this isn't any different than science fiction and fantasy. You create a planet.
Oh, I love that.
It's the same thing. Is that the book club turns out to be the kind of central focus of these women, and it's almost like a sorority, mm-hmm. you know, a college sorority, and the woman who runs it. It does it on kind of military lines. Have you had an experience with that yourself with a book club like that?
No, I actually, one of the reasons I wrote about a book club is when I was doing, what after one of my earlier books was published, I visited a lot of book clubs and I just loved them. It's such a, there is such a warmth and sort of this kind of casual, warm, anything goes energy. I wasn't in a sorority, so I don't really, but it is kind of like, and they were all mostly women, so I'm going to say sisterhood, maybe, you know, but there just was such a camaraderie is what I should say. And a wonderful, I don't know if it's, you know, people talking about books, you know, kind of loosen something up. I don't know if it's sort of the after hours, perhaps the wine, but I was just trying to capture that sort of buoying support and that feeling by making it a book club. So even though Janine is very militant, as you point out, and she is, she was more as a character, she was sort of more an embodiment of the quest for perfection and how someone could just kind of, you know, almost crack under it. So that, but I have never fortunately been at a book club that is that, that, you know, with such strict rules. And I was really, it really was sort of a love letter to the, you know, to book clubs that I've been at. So that I was trying to kind of capture that feeling.
I mean, they can be wonderful. My husband belongs to one. We were both invited. And then I realized that for me, off hours, leisure does not really want to involve.
Busman's holiday, right?
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, he really loves it. And it works very well on Zoom because really mm-hmm. the object is for people to come together and talk about something that they have in common now. They've read the book.
Exactly.
And while their opinions, their experiences may be different, their interpretations may be different and all, mm-hmm. they have a common ground for discussion.
Yes. Yes.
And it invites, in fact, different opinions and, you know, illuminates things. So he really loves it. We have three of them at the Poison Pen.
You do.
Run by different members of our staff. And I think that Zoom has enhanced them
mm-hmm.
because before it was only people who could show up in downtown Scottsdale that could, you know, belong. Right. And now it's a much wider thing. And I think that people really value a sense of community, a sense mm-hmm. of being able to share ideas. But I will tell you that I belonged to one for many years in a part of the country which I was never actually should never have been, which is in the Deep South. And I'm yes, right. And so it was all okay for a long time. Most of the women were somewhat older than I, but we met and we read, the University of Chicago had an amazing reading list called the Great Books Program, which as a senior in high school I had embarked on. So we were reading pretty deep stuff most of the time. And we were reading philosophy and all these other things. I thought I really knew these women after several years and, you know, constant meetings talking about all this. And then one day, somebody filed a suit against the school system in a nearby community. And it was like the Scopes trial revisited. And I realized that I was deep in Baptist country. And despite everything that this book club had done, if you scratch the surface of a couple of these women, they deep down believe that you should not be teaching evolution and all that. I was just so, I almost never got over that, you know, because I really thought I knew them. And in your book, clearly, you know, despite this facade, well, actually a genuine coming together in the whole bit, what you reveal is that same sort of thing when you discover that the people that you thought you knew so well from the book club, you actually don't.
I was going to say that was your neighbor's secret or book club secret moment, right?
It was, although, I mean, it wasn't murderous or anything, but it did remind me that, you know, you can't overcome some aspects of people's psyche. You can't really overcome religion. You can't really overcome some cultural values. And, you know, the South is, that part of the South is truly foreign to me. And I thought that I knew it, but it turned out it was a lot thinner of a relationship than I had realized. It really rocked me back.
And it is true, because like you said, when you're sort of communing over ideas and discussing them, then you can kind of think or be tricked in, I know I've done, into thinking that the bond is something different or the similarities are perhaps more deeper than they actually are.
Well, we weren't reading Peyton Place. We were reading Plato.
Right.
You know, and that's the part that really threw me, you know, is how did we manage to work our way through the great books and all of this Hegel, you know, and all the rest of it, and then suddenly crash into the Scopes trial. It was like we'd gone to Mars or something. I mean, that if we had just, you know, if we'd been reading, you know, contemporary fiction or something, it wouldn't have been such a surprise.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
So what's the agenda in your book club? What is it that in the Cottonwood Estates, what is it that they read?
What do they read? Well, they read, it's a selection. They read thrillers, kind of real, you know, gripping the sides of the chair thrillers. They read parenting books, a lot of how-tos. There's one every year, the Mommy Guilt book, one character calls it. They read historical fiction. There are books about the Holocaust, and there's a book about, I made all these books up. The only book I didn't make up was the Nabokov, Lolita. And I thought he could take it, you know, he could kind of like being torn apart by these women, but I didn't want to include real books because, you know, part of it is the sanctity of this group and Cottonwood and being able to be honest and discuss whatever they want to discuss. They talk, there's a book about Toulouse-Lautrec's lover that's historical fiction. So they read a variety.
Do they have a mechanism for disagreement, or do they just, you know, is it a group that can agree to disagree but still stay cohesive?
There are healthy debates, but nothing's ever going to get too deep into conflict.
So if you're having a successful book club in person, mm-hmm. One of the things you have to do is schedule it. You have mm-hmm. to agree on when it meets, what day of the week, what hour, and yes, you have to agree upon who's hosting it. Mm-hmm. And that can be, in a way, that can be a real trauma if you're inviting people into your home, because they get to sit there and examine your life. How do they deal with that?
Well, I think some of them love it and can't wait to host perfectly. And it's, of course, very clean, and they know just where the book club's going to go. And I think some of them, one in particular, I'm sure, is sort of terrified at the thought of hosting. And there's a character, Jen, who in a moment of weakness agrees to host, and she's new to the neighborhood, and she's in a house that someone else lived in before, and everyone in the book club feels like they know her house and they're telling her about, oh no, your countertops aren't granite, they're soapstone, you know, so they feel a sense of propriety and ownership over her house. And she is by nature somewhat of an introvert and less of a joiner. And so it just really freaks her out. All of it freaks her out, but she gets through it. She gets through it. And they say to her, don't worry, we're going to do everything. And they do, because that's what the Cottonwood Book Club does. They would swoop in like that and just take care of everything.
I love it. This is a thriller, but it's also, there's a lot of humor in it. Yeah, so I could see that you had a good time. And in fact, there's a wonderful review of Allison's book, which I'm going to quote from here because I really liked it. And the last paragraph starts out, Heller's fine-handed humor realistically illustrates the absurdities that can arise daily at a woke potluck backfires. Silly drinks are concocted to match the book discussion. Regifted soaps with two bars missing, for example. And so you have a lot of fun at in a nice way and without disturbing the story of poking fun at this kind of small community and its life, right?
Thank you. Yeah, I did. I had a lot of fun with it. And there is something, I think, well, there's something just inherently funny about life, and then let alone a neighborhood where everyone's working so hard to try and make everything so perfect all the time. You got to poke fun at that, I think. So yeah, I did have fun with that.
Well, and it makes it a really enjoyable read. Is this what one would call in the modern parlance a slow burn thriller? It does not start out with slam bang action, and there's room for humor and for a number of things. So thriller is a word that more often implies, you know, faster pacing and a real villain and an antagonist, all that. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really sure that slow burn thriller is the right word. Psychological suspense, though, doesn't seem to me to quite right either. So we're just going to call it fiction.
Fiction.
All right. So this review starts out, secrets and gossip and the fear that those confidences may leak out seep through the upscale Cottonwood Estates community where every resident has something to hide. Now that is so Miss Marple. That is Miss Marple in the village. That's Murder at the Vicarage, if you think about it. So are you a fan of that kind of classic form, and did you enjoy, you know, modernizing it?
Yes, I do love the classic form. I love mysteries that blend character and the mysteries too. I try to read everything, because then that was part of my process of going from contemporary fiction, we'll call it, to writing suspense, was reading a lot of mysteries and seeing how, seeing where the information was hidden, and trying to recognize where I was duped and when. So I am a fan. I love a puzzle. I do love a puzzle.
There's a new book, I'm trying to think, I talked to her in July, by B.A. Paris. Patrick will now rescue me because I can't remember the title, but he will use the chat feature to tell me what it is. But anyway, well, it's very helpful. But anyway, it's a similar thing in that we're in London, but we are in a gated community in London, and this woman leaves her much-loved home in a village outside London to move in with her boyfriend in a house that he has bought them in this gated community. Mm-hmm. And it turns out just like the Cottonwood Estates, that everybody living in the gated community has a secret. And, you know, there's it's not the same as your book. There's a murder and all the rest of it, but it's a similar design for, thank you very much. I knew he'd help me out. The therapist is called. Yes, the chat feature for Zoom is really amazingly helpful, especially if your memory is not what it once was. But I mean, it's interesting to compare, because I've read them both now fairly close together. It's interesting to compare the gated community or the estates or so that she's created, that Paris has created in London, and then your Cottonwood Estates. Mm-hmm. You know. And I mean, they're very different, but at the same time, the dynamics of them are very similar. And as a plot device, they are almost identical.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
Yeah.
Who was it also that recently wrote a book similar to this? And it was, in order to make the community work, it ends up in a lake. I mean, it's a community around a lake and there are only so many buildings. Oh,
was it the Megan Miranda?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That was great.
She actually has a map. You know,
What's it called again?
A Hidden Place or something? Does that sound about right?
I think Patrick
will save us. In
but the Megan Moran, I know, and all her stuff is great. And I read it and I loved it.
But that occurred to me too, that again, it's a very similar thing. And it was helpful the way that story works. She had a map of the way that the homes were laid out. And I found myself referring to it. Which I didn't need for your book, but you know, it was the specific geography of that community was an important part of the plot.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in your case, the specific geography is not.
Right. Although I did have a map, just while drafting, of where everyone lived and kind of how the cul-de-sacs went and the loop. Because that was helpful to think, could that one get to that's how, you know, would they drive? Just to kind of get a better sense of the reality of what was going on and the distance between and how big.
Right. So we've danced all around the idea that there's Megan Miranda is called Such a Quiet Place. That's what it was called. I was close with Hidden Place. That's it, Patrick. Thank you. Such a Quiet Place. Really good book. And Megan and I discussed it, and B.A. Paris and I discussed. So if you're interested, you can go back to our Facebook page and you can find Megan Miranda and I think B.A. Paris both in July. You just have to go back. We've created this archive, which I might tell you after the Facebook blowout on Monday, we are also going to migrate, not remove it from Facebook, but we're going to duplicate it on YouTube as a safety measure. We should have done it a while back, and some of it already exists on YouTube, but boy, it was a wake-up call.
That was.
Really was, yeah. So now we've talked about absolutely everything else. What's the actual plot of your book? Can you sum it up without giving anything away?
I will try. I feel like this is what's so amazing is there have been so many readers and reviewers who have done a better job than I can. I'm like, oh, that's so good. I wish. But basically, it is about a book club in a suburban community, and the story revolves around three women. They're more members in the book club, but there are three main characters and alternating viewpoints, and there is a murder that has happened 15 years before. And that wasn't a spoiler. I just misspoke. There was an accident that happened 15 years before. And so the three women basically 15 years later meet and go meet in the book club and become close to each other. And this is, I'm trying so hard not to give spoilers. But basically, they befriend each other and they get close and they learn information about what happened all those years before, and what happens results in another death. It was so vague. See, the review.
There's only so much you can say. Unfortunately, when we do these events at the beginning of the publication cycle, we have to be so careful not to spoil the book. It would be a lot more fun in many ways if we discussed this 6 months from now and a requirement would be. it'd be a book club essentially that you would right. have read it. But basically the quote instigating incident, which is what you really require in a crime novel, there has to be some instigating incident, probably happened in the past.
And, yes.
And then much of the book is it's not really like a cold case investigation, but much of the book is traveling back into the past to try to find out what really happened. And one of the women who had been a real star in this community, a real community leader, has become a virtual recluse. And the new woman wonders why and mm-hmm. decides to befriend her. Mm-hmm. And that really starts this whole mm-hmm. this whole process. It's a very well constructed story, and I enjoyed, you know, I enjoyed that. But what's really fun, in addition to figuring out what actually happened, is all this other stuff. And if you've ever belonged to a book club or aspired to belong to a book club, or you know, you'll recognize a lot of things. If you live in a small community that perhaps has a HOA or, you know, people who want to mind your business for you. And there's usually one in every HOA. There is usually, you know, my husband calls one of our neighbors the Nazi. There's usually somebody that cares more about the rules and so forth than anybody else. And, you know, that can be, it's almost like a My Sister's Keeper thing or something, you know, but that is indeed a dynamic that comes in any group. I was amused to read in the Arizona Republic today that in one of these developer buying a whole land, you know, ranch type thing and dividing it into houses and all, the temptation to put in fast growing trees and other landscaping is enormous. And in Arizona, if you just add water, things grow, right? I mean, it takes no time at all. And they put in some kind of a tree, and I can't remember the exact, it's not a tree I'm familiar with, starts with a B. And they created this kind of like alley, you know, where you, if you travel to France or somewhere and you see these beautiful long alleys of plane trees or, you know, whatever it is. Anyway, they thought they'd give this community a great look, and they planted these trees and watered them. And what they failed to understand was that these trees have hugely encroaching roots. So the roots have come up and cracking the underground pipes, they're cracking the walls, they're cracking, you know, the paving and all the rest of it. And now the question is what to do about it. Are the homeowners liable now for having to deal with these trees, you know, and how are they going to just cut them all down? That's one school. Or are they going to get in an arborist and, you know, take care of the trees and trim them? And I mean, it was a big front page article in the paper today, exactly the kind of thing, you know, we're talking about.
And see, it was so well-intentioned, right? It was.
Absolutely. It was so and beautiful, but you know, it's hard to look 20 years down the road and imagine. We had, when we lived in our first house here, they had put in instant landscaping, and one of them were olive trees. And what they didn't take into account was that olive trees fruit, and when they fruit, they splat. And, you know, and suddenly you have, you know, like this carpet of squishy olives. And so what do? Do you spray your tree to keep it from fruiting, or do you, you know, go through the cleanup process, or do you decide to brine your own olives and pretend you're Greek? Or,
right.
You know, what is it you actually do in a case like that? And unfortunately, I mean, I'll stop with all this, but the long-term, people don't really think in terms of long-term consequences. You're a lawyer by training, I'm a lawyer by training. So, you know, we tend to think that way. But because they put in all this stuff, a lot of it was chopped down and kind of buried or mulched into the ground. And so what was the result from that? Want to guess?
Oh.
Termites. Became an absolute termite haven. Because all of the food that they need is right there.
Oh, it's a paradise.
Soil, and then they invade your house, you know? So it's a really complicated thing to create a community and then deal with, you know, things that down the road that nobody really anticipated.
Exactly. And it is, I love that. I love those. I mean, I don't love those stories. They're sad, but that just that notion of the best, you know, the best intentions, trying to do something beautiful, trying to improve, and then just the domino effect of what happens next and the unforeseen consequences. It's really, I mean, because that is, I'm very much, I think that is such a part of life. It's inescapable. And it's kind of it's a quiet theme of the book in a way.
Well, it really is. And the other thing, again, we can't really talk about it, but the other thing is when you go excavate the past and into people's lives, you also change their lives. And mm-hmm. So one of the other interesting things to read in the book is how, what is going to be the fallout from unearthing the past, and how will it change the lives of various women involved. And I thought, we can't discuss it, but I thought you did a really excellent job.
Thank you.
End game, you know, because there has to be one, of talking about all that. I mean, you're very kind.
Oh, thank you. Thank
well,
you.
You are, you know, because you could have been a lot more ruthless or unkind, but I think you were compassionate.
It's hard to spend. I really love the characters, and I don't know if you could tell. I loved even Janine. Like I have very fond feelings for her, as ridiculous and foot and mouth as she is. And I think it is hard for me to spend so much time with them. I spend a lot of time with the book club, with the women of the book club. And it's just, you know, I only grew more fond of them and more, you know, kind of felt more empathy toward them. So that is kind of you to say, and I guess it's good you picked up on that too, that my affection for them.
And basically, this is a book that doesn't invite a sequel. I mean, when it's over, it's over. So my last question to you before we call Patrick back up to see if he has anything he wants to add or people do, what are you working on now? Because it's always good to let people know that
definitely
there'll be a new book forthcoming someday.
I'm really excited about what I'm working on now. And I'm triply excited that I get to do it with the same amazing editor who worked on The Neighbor's Secret with me. And so I'm working on it's Count of Monte Cristo inspired. So it is a revenge tale. And that's all I will say now, because I know it's going to change a lot in between now and
that's another wonderful template. It's actually my husband's favorite book.
Oh, and I have to tell you, when I've read it quite a few times now, and when I first read it, it's real adventure fiction, and so it's not necessarily the genre that I go to. And I read it, and then I read it again, and you can't put it down, the way he does action, the way he pulls you in, and there are so many characters, and there's so much going on, and it doesn't matter, he just pulls you along. So yes, it is a magnificent template, and I'm having a lot of fun with it. Slightly less fun than I had with this one. Now it's a little darker, but we'll see. I might find the fun. That might be kind of, I might be unable to not. So
you're moving firmly into away from contemporary women's stories and more into this whole suspense. And you have an excellent publisher for doing that with. I mean, Flatiron is a very interesting publisher, and the women who started it are amazing, I think.
Amazing.
They produce some terrific books. I mean, really, for a relatively new publishing imprint house, whatever you want to call it, they've had some remarkable successes.
They are dynamos. I am incredibly, incredibly lucky. It's true.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely wonderful. So, Patrick, why don't you pop back in and lend us, you know, why don't you talk about seminal fiction? I mean, we're having this good time. One of the things Patrick and I have noticed, the store has all noticed that during the last 2 years under COVID, we have sold this enormous number of classics. I mean, they might have sat around forever, but I do all the reordering for the store, and I can hardly believe, you know, the turnover for, and I'm not talking just crime. I'm talking, you know, Kurt Vonnegut and, you know, all kinds of stuff. Have you talked to people in the store, Patrick, buying classics? What do they say?
Yeah, I think that, at least for a while anyway, I think that the lockdown gave people obviously a lot of time on their hands. And it was a good chance to tackle, you know, tackle these big books that you've always wanted to read, but never made the time to do it. And it's funny, I have a friend also, this isn't book related, but I have a friend who works for Fender Musical Instruments, which has a big hub here in the Phoenix area in Scottsdale. And he said, you know, kind of like us, that Fender had like this, you know, record shattering year, you know, because everybody was buying instruments, you know, and buying things to do. Very, very interesting. But yeah, I'm seeing that trend a lot. And also long running series, you know, people digging into long running mystery series.
But you know, the good news is if people are reading classics, let's say in crime fiction, if I say to you, that's a real Miss Marple Village mystery, more people will know what I actually meant by that. Or if I say to J.T. Ellison, you've just rewritten Rebecca, you know, people will know, I mean, a Gothic classic, what you're talking about. And I think part of the fun of crime fiction in particular is to recognize new treatments of classic forms, such as, you know, such as you have done. But if you've never read the classics, you don't have any idea what's going on. You don't recognize the tribute and the Easter eggs.
Right.
So yeah, I suspect as far as questions that there may be some of your peeps lurking in the comments.
I'm not sure. Are they just this. Like, yay, go?
He's a trained investigator, having spent all these years.
Well, there are plenty of those kind of comments, but one Sarah, and I won't reveal her last name, says, are any of the characters in your book inspired by people you know?
It was an inevitable question.
Allison. I do know a Sarah who I think is going to be on here. So they're all based on you, Sarah. Just kidding. No, they're not at all. I mean, I think there's a lot of some of the characters' fears about how the decisions they make as a parent, fears about their children are definitely, you know, and the kind of that line between how do you protect without overstepping that boundary. I think that theme is based on thoughts I've had or conversations I've had with friends. But as far as characteristics, and no, they're not based on anyone, all fiction.
All right, let's see. Christine wants to know if you had any input into your cover design.
I was shown two covers, and I love this cover. So I mean, the input I had, I saw it and I was like, it's totally perfect. There is nothing I would change about it. And that was the cover. I think there was some like, oh, let's try this font, or, you know, there was something like, but it was like love at first sight.
Let's see. Okay. Christina wants to know, do you have any current go-to book recommendations for book clubs?
Yes. Well,
she didn't actually say for book clubs.
Oh, for book clubs. Okay.
What is your current go-to book recommendation?
That anything Tana French, I'm always recommending her. I think she's amazing. I really, really loved The Bass Rock by Evie Wilde, but it gets very dark. So maybe read about it and make sure it sounds okay, because it is on the darker side, but it's fantastic. Chandler Baker's The Husbands, which is on my shelf, is absolutely amazing. I loved it, and I felt like Nora, the main character, Cottonwood Estates, would be lucky to get her. So those are three recent reads that that I would recommend.
I've been looking at your bookshelf and I recognize a lot of these. You have Jane Harper, The Dry.
She's amazing too.
We've done programs with her.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have the David Grand book about the killers of the flower moon. Is that what?
Yeah, I love that. That one too.
Great book.
On the shelf.
Especially. Amy Stewart. Is that Amy Stewart, the Wicked Plants book or whatever?
Yeah. The Wicked Plants book.
Yeah. She's really.
Isn't that a great cover? Yeah. Love that.
Yeah. This is more, I don't know. I mean, it's a different kind of read, but very interesting. And then, you know, there's the Count of Monte Cristo up there too, but yeah. So
any interest from Hollywood yet? For this book?
So far, no.
Not yet. Well, maybe somebody's listening.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Get the word out, Patrick.
That's right. By the way, Barbara, were you referring to sisu trees by any chance?
Yes, I was. Thank you. I could not remember. Did you read that article in the paper?
No, but we had one.
Oh, that's what they were?
We ripped it out because the roots just go crazy.
Yeah, I mean, and they really, there's a photo and they're really handsome trees, but, you know, they are destructive just the way they are. And so the huge fight is whether to just cut them all down and remove them, which is not an easy process, by the way, and could lead to termites, as I've already pointed out, unless they haul them all out. But to try to deal with them, I think very expensive project, and could involve the gas company and the water company and all, because the roots are so. I didn't know you had one at your house, Patrick.
Well, we had to rip it out because it was doing just that, and it was close to, you know, our old 1920s era pipes and stuff, so we had to rip it out. Yeah. It looked kind of like an ash tree, but anyway, not to talk about trees during your program.
Well, but, you know, I hate to lose any tree, because I mean, trees not only are great in terms of shade and climate control, but they're also, you know, really helpful for carbon monoxide. I mean, they're a natural improver of the atmosphere. So my objection to be ripping out this enormous number of trees would be that. And then the question would be, would they be replaced? Because now we're talking a tremendous amount of money. I mean, taking them down might be a quick fix, but what goes back up is a whole different question.
Ugh. Well, people need to do the deep watering stakes and stuff, which they don't do, you know, and direct the roots to go down. But we're totally digressing into tree territory here. I apologize. But during the month,
I brought it up, so yeah, you know, it's my fault.
And it's a metaphor we've already discussed, right?
Yes, it's true. Is the what was it called? Cottonwood Estates? Is that the community? Is that a literal, or is it based on a community where you live?
It is the land is there is. For people who are in Colorado, it's sort of the area west on 285, kind of in the Hogbacks and in the foothills, kind of Morrison-esque. So that's there are a few beautiful subdivisions there that I very much had in mind as I wrote it. But
is that where Red Rocks is, by the way?
Very, very close to Red Rocks. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Oh. Excellent reference, Patrick. That's exactly where it is. So yeah, it's just kind of over something from Red Rocks. You can probably see Red Rocks. So but I don't live there, although it would sure be nice to. It's beautiful, but I don't live there. But that was kind of the neighborhood that I had in mind. And it there is a loop and it kind of goes up, and so you are sort of in this protected.
Is it kind of like Whoville?
Kind of like Whoville. Yes. Yes. With many secret Grinches.
Let's
see. We have some communities like that here in North Scottsdale, yes. Silverleaf and
Sarasota. That are up in the.
Well, they're mountains sort of rise, but, you know, they're enclaves that are very much of their own. I did a program many years ago for a book club in one of them. I think it might have been the James Lee Burke one, Patrick, where I took the video of Jim and so forth. But anyway, I remember that at least two people attending it said they never leave it. never come down into Metro Phoenix, you know. It's so complete in and of itself that there's no particular reason to go out beyond the boundaries. And I thought that was a very interesting insight.
Yeah, definitely. Well, everybody has their own little grocery store, and you know.
Well, you'd need that if you were, or either that, now you can have everything delivered. So you could actually live in a place like that and never set foot out of it. But you, right. You know, everything can be brought in. So
yeah, I think Lena would have loved that, the character Lena.
Well, I think the pandemic has probably really strengthened, mm-hmm. you know, strengthened that. Many people have decided, rather than living in a densely urban environment, that they will spread out, and the fact that the internet allows communication and delivery services abound makes it possible. But what you do find out, and the danger of it is certainly California has learned, and we may well, that, you know, you're in danger in a fire zone. You may be in a place that's going to run out of water. You don't have immediate access to fire or police service. You may be too far from a hospital. You know, there's a downside to
to you that. You realize how fragile these systems really can be.
Yep.
Yeah.
Anything else?
I don't know. Anybody send in some more questions? Nothing yet. Let's see. I think we've asked all the questions.
Oh, we have. We've been intense and wide scope and all the rest of it.
We covered it.
Didn't Flatiron do the book that you like so much, Barbara, The Plot by Korolitz? The Plot? Wasn't that what it was called? The Plot?
Oh, Jean Hanf Korolitz, The Plot. Yeah, absolutely wonderful book. And yeah, wasn't that
John Cosby's books too, or Flatiron? Those are great.
Yeah, no, I said they have done some absolutely remarkable and hugely successful. Isn't The Silent Patient, the Michelotis, I think might be theirs, or maybe it's the maybe that's Celadon. There are two new imprints that are part of the Macmillan family, relatively recent imprints. One's called Flatiron, and it's really named for the classic, the iconic building in New York called the Flatiron Building. That it's like a triangle, comes up to Washington Square. And then there's one called Celadon. Mm-hmm. And I think Michelotti's might be with Celadon. But anyway, they're small. And they have found a home. It's almost like boutique publishing within this much larger publishing conglomerate, Macmillan. And clearly they're being left to do their own thing. You know, that they see, clearly have a lot of freedom to acquire and publish books. And I think that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, where there are only five major publishers left and may soon only be four. It's great if there are a series of kind of boutique houses within these larger conglomerates that can take advantage of central warehousing and distribution and all that kind of thing and accounting, but still have their own personalities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Definitely. Sarah chimes in with a question. Thank you, Sarah. She asks, how did the book change over the course of writing it?
Ooh, that's a very good question.
That's such a good question. So there were some, it took me a really long time to, it took me a couple years to get a draft, or maybe under 2 years to get a draft, but then there were so many drafts after that. So it was always, I'm going to do this without spoilers, which we know is not, this means I might get a little word salad-y, but there were a few main secrets that were from day one, that didn't change. But there were many more secrets that were added in. The characterizations changed a lot. Not Jen. Jen was Jen from the get-go. Lena was Lena from the get-go. Annie changed a lot. And what was going on in Annie's life changed a lot. And there was just, and also sort of the, there is a first person viewpoint that sprinkled throughout the book, which that changed a lot too. And so there were, I would say the skeleton sort of remained the same, but there were just so many, the flesh is radically different, you know, or feels like it's changed a lot.
Kelly wants to know if the book was always called The Neighbor's Secret. Was that your title, or were there other titles?
There were other titles. It was the first title. The title that I shopped it with was Local Secrets. And then for a while it was A Little Bit of Violence. Which I loved, but it's kind of hard to say, you know, it's kind of hard to say. So anyway, I think probably when we started honing in on publication, it was changed to The Neighbor's Secret, which I love, because the word secret is just, I think it's one of the best words in the world. So
it's a very good title. I agree with you. And looking at the books behind Patrick, you know, it's a very nice cover. In between behind Patrick, there's a skull, which I like.
It's shows the skull. It's great. Right.
Little atmosphere here that we
Hamlet,
have.
Right. Hamlet thing going on here.
The Hamlet thing, you are. And yeah, that is all the title, the cover, that is all the geniuses at Flatiron. You know, they just, that's.
Christina.
They're very professional. They've done a very professional job. The designing and the packaging of a book is really important. Mm-hmm. And working with the author to bring the best version of the story that's available, but it can't go on forever. And you know, one of the things that you have to recognize if you want to be a published writer is at some point you have to let it go. And so the question is, you know, where in this whole process, when do you know that you can let it go?
Right. Right. The book itself, you mean, and just kind of let it out in the world?
Yeah. I mean, at some point you have to stop writing the story.
Oh,
and
right.
Turn it over to the people who are going to turn it into a book and do the packaging.
Absolutely.
And do the marketing and sell it. I mean, you know, you could keep rewriting a book forever, but then you will not be a published writer.
Right. It's true. And I do think you could literally work on a book forever and, you know, probably continue to improve it. I mean, you could probably also make it worse, but...
Right. Well, I mean, there are many instances of people who work on a book forever and therefore it never goes anywhere. Which
never goes.
This has really been a treat to meet you, Allison. We
Likewise.
Haven't, I think, actually done an event together before, but yeah. What good news to know that she's working on another book that will give us a second chance. Hooray. Meantime, The Neighbor's Secret, there it is. And Allison is going to zip down to whatever carrier she chooses. Some of you may have noticed that the post office decided it's going to take 5 days to deliver a first-class letter. So one of the questions I would like to know is, why is this guy still running the post office? But, you know, that's not up for debate tonight. As soon as they get here on the book plates, we will be happy to include one in your copy of the book, which I highly recommend that you buy.
So I shall take the speediest option. I shall find whatever speediest.
I'm just mentioning it. I mean, there are so many annoyances on a daily basis. You know, you have to stick with the one that really grinds you. And one of them is that I think the mail should not be slower than it was when Pony Express actually delivered it. I mean, what are we doing? Anyway, thank you, Allison. Thank you, Patrick. And we really appreciate all of you who spent some time with us tonight. There will be a podcast of this conversation, and the video will live on forever on our Facebook and soon YouTube pages. So if you know anybody who missed it who would enjoy it, you could certainly recommend that they take it up. So good night, everybody.
Thank you. Good night. This was great. Thanks, everyone, for coming.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.